Hi, you're listening to another sermon from Deep Creek Anglican Church.
So we turn another chapter. You know, I hope you've all got a texter and a bit of paper. You'll know what to do with them at the time where I tell you what to do with them. If you want, you can fill one side with a little picture now, if that helps you think as I speak. I'm a drawer when other people speak. That's just how I work. But we've turned another chapter in Daniel 6, and we've got a whole new set of characters. Babylon has fallen to the hands of the Persians. Darius the Mede has added a new portfolio to his mighty Persian empire. And we already know Daniel as a godly man of integrity. Darius has obviously seen this really quickly. He's appointed Daniel to a high position. Daniel was 80 at this time, so he wasn't a young man, but he still must have been really sharp in his oversight of the people. Daniel was appointed as one of the three administrators above the 120 satraps and officials. So that is administrators under the administrator, and they function to collect taxes within the land. So Daniel was already hand-picked, ready to be placed over the whole kingdom. Now for the administrators, this was almost like Tony Mockbell appointing over his organized crime family, perhaps Livio, let's say, and even Tony's surprised. Now, if Livio was in charge of making sure the gang kept to the rules, turned in all the money, didn't charge too much, he'd keep them in order, wouldn't you? Yeah, you'd keep them in order. And it wouldn't have gone down well with them, because they wouldn't have been able to continue corruption. But you don't join a gang just because you want to, just because you like the boss. You join because you want a share of his money, his power, his lifestyle, those sorts of things. And with Livio in charge, what you can sneak away from the boss is going to be significantly less than, say, maybe if I was in charge. If anything at all, is what you're going to be able to sneak away under him. What's more, he's so competent at that job that you're never actually going to be able to replace him in that job, because he's better than you at it, than you would be at it already. Soon enough, Tony. soon enough, Livio becomes the obstacle in the way of what you want. It was the same for Daniel. He was in the way of what the administrators and the satraps wanted in the kingdom. There was nothing in it for them, so they decided to snooker Darius and get rid of his best administrator, Daniel. They were smart guys. They knew Darius's weakness. He loved the approval of people. He loved himself. He loved power. He just conquered another city. Why not? Let's proclaim a law that says, no one should bow down and worship anything or any god except for me for the next 30 days. It would have sounded good to him. So Daniel, a faithful worshipper, doing what he's always done, continued to bow down and worship. He wasn't the kind of guy that would bow down to idols. He wasn't the kind of guy that would stop bowing down to his god when other people said that he couldn't worship. The administrators and the satraps childishly caught him and dobbed him in. And then Darius realized what had happened. They caught him out. Now he realized he was about to lose his best administrator. In fact, Daniel was probably the only guy that he could trust, because others had proved themselves already untrustworthy in what they'd just done. Now, it's obvious that he liked Daniel, but let's face it, they'd only known each other a short while. There was no long relationship of shared work. There was no long-term friendship or loyalty going to be there. I think Daniel's usefulness to him was the key thing that was reverberating around in his head as he entered this situation. We look at this passage and we think, oh, he's a kind king. But I think this is the thing that is going on here. He's losing his best administrator. Particularly since he was stuck with a group of administrators that were going to, they're willing to play games with him. They're willing to dishonor his name. They're willing to eliminate a rival in order to get what they want. And those aren't the kind of people that you want working for you. What's more, he's found his power, the power that he thought was in the laws, has now been turned against him. Daniel's fate is sealed with the lions. There's no escape for Daniel. Daniel's only point of trust would be that God might deliver him. He's given no option out. Darius's hope is that maybe Daniel might survive the night and then he can put into place another custom, which is if someone survives the night after a torture like this, then they've suffered enough and you can release them. Look how we see Darius act, and you can see his heart as he comes away. If you look at Daniel 6 in verse 18. Then the king returned to his palace, and he spent the night without eating, without entertainment being brought to him, and he could not sleep. It's the kind of mood you're in when you know your world's kind of falling apart, when the rug's been pulled out from underneath you, you're stressed and you can't sleep. Darius' reign in this part of the kingdom has been undermined. He'd been let down, and the thing that he valued most had been stripped from him. For Darius, the object of his worship was clearly himself at some level. He was his own idol, and the power he thought he had was somehow not as great as he thought it was. The greatness of his laws was something he worshipped. The superiority of his judgment was something he highly valued. He looked to the law he created as a base for his identity, a firm rock on which he could stand, and then it was crumbling as it was used against him, and it was an idol for him. What we see here is a man whose idols have been stripped away from him in genuine anguish over what was happening. Was there genuine anguish over Daniel being potentially eaten by the lions? Probably a little, but you can't separate it from that feeling he would have had as he knew that his kingdom was threatened. He thought the law served him, but it turned out that he actually served the laws he created to serve him. A few weeks ago when I was looking at Daniel 3 with us, I touched on the topic of idolatry. We're going to look a bit more on that topic this morning and how the things of what we place in our lives, things of worship, can take the place of God. How the things we worship in our lives, the idols, can take the place of most affection in our hearts. And so that's what idols are about. Let me remind you some of the ways we can identify idols. I said idols are the things we cannot give up when or if God asks us to. Idols are what we look to save us and give our lives meaning instead of God. Idols are things we prioritize most, things that consume us, things we obsess over, things we worship in the place of God, that have that center of affection in our hearts. So Darius thought the law served him, but it turned out he was serving the law. And one of the realities of idols in our lives is it's the nature of idols that they're not alive. They need serving themselves. The person whose idol is power, what do we describe them as? Power hungry. They're always seeking more power to expand their power base. The person whose idol is money, they never have enough money. They're always seeking more money. They're amassing a fortune, money that they don't need. Marissa shared earlier about Makeup Free Me, the girl whose idol is beauty. They're always looking to perfect their beauty, to put on more makeup, to find the perfect product, the next fashion accessory, the next clothing item to serve that idol, and you're in a losing battle because your body is getting older and you're going to continually have to patch up more. The guy whose idol is beauty, always lifting the heavier weights, always measuring up, these days hours in front of the mirror grooming as well. an idol that needs to be continually fed. The person who looks at pornography is serving an idol. It's not serving them. The gossip is serving an idol as they seek more and more information. The person that cares too much about what others think can never hear enough about what others think about them in positive affirmation. They're serving an idol. The person addicted to eating, the Bible says the God is their stomach. Their God is their stomach. They're feeding an idol. Idols are things we serve to sustain. But idols aren't just bad things. Idols are good things as well. They're the things that take that center place of affection in our hearts. One of the key idols in our society is family. Family can become and take that place of center in our heart. And it's hard for us to comprehend this. How can family be an idol? It's a good thing that God's given us. But if Jesus isn't the center of our hearts, if our decisions aren't governed by what Jesus says, they're instead governed by the needs and the wants of our family, then the family becomes an idol. And anyone who's got a family knows that a family has an endless ability to consume your ability to feed that family. If Jesus, but you can have the two things working together. If you're asking Jesus, how are you wanting our family to live? How are you wanting our family to grow? What are you wanting our family to do? Then Jesus is at the center and your family is serving Jesus. And so family can be an idol that takes the place of Jesus. And it, like other things, has an endless ability to consume our ability. Work. There's never enough time in the day to get all the work done that we have to get done. And so work in our culture is a massive idol as we seek to get something, to be saved, to receive purpose through what we do in work. And when we achieve something good, we feel great about it. And that's a good thing. But if our moods, our highs and our lows depend on achieving good things in work, it's an indicator that work in some ways has become an idol in our lives. Now, Daniel served and worshipped God before anything or anyone else. And look with me at verse 19, what happens when Darius visits him, having had no sleep. At the first light of dawn, the king got up, and he hurried to the lion's den. When he came near the den, he called to Daniel in an anguished voice, "Daniel, servant of the living God, has your God, whom you serve continually, been able to rescue you from the lions?" Daniel answered, "May the king live forever." It's funny that he says this because the administrators, as they came to put in place this law that put Daniel there in the first place, said the same thing, "May you live forever." But here, Daniel, with a genuine heart, is able to serve the king, but not have the king as his idol. So Daniel goes on, "My God sent his angel. God was present with him, and he shut the mouth of the lions. They have not hurt me, because I was found innocent in his sight. Nor have I ever done any wrong before you, your majesty." The king was overjoyed and gave orders to lift Daniel out of the den. When Daniel was lifted from the den, no wound was found on him because he trusted in God. No wound was found on Daniel because he trusted in God. God was at the center of his affections. Daniel served and worshipped the living God and he was rescued. No idol would have been able to save him. Yet here is Daniel without even a wound on him. Daniel was 80. God could have said to Daniel, "Look, mate, you've lived a long time. It's been a good innings. Now's your time." But God didn't. He was graceful to him. Daniel served and worshipped the living God who saves, who is able to save, and no idol can claim that for itself. Not only this, but we see at the end of the chapter that the king wrote a decree that all people would fear and reverence the God of Daniel. The irony is he still, at some level, worships the law. But the result for Daniel was that he prospered greatly under God's rule. In Daniel, he lived a life mixed between prosperity and hardship. We've looked at these last six chapters, and what he's lived hasn't been an easy life. But what we see, his faith has been tested. And through these times, God has sustained him. And here was a man whose faith had not been shaken. So who did or what did the administrators worship? What was their idol? It was most likely power. It was probably money. They wanted it. They wanted more of it. They didn't have enough of it. What happens when someone gets in the way of our idols is that we get angry, we get vengeful, and we try and change the situation. An easy one to think of is, I don't know about you, but sometimes I'll lie in bed a little bit longer in the morning, just delaying hopping up and hopping into the shower as long as I possibly can. Someone else hops in the shower just before you, as you are planning to get up. Oh, doesn't it stir up the anger in you? on the road, as you're sitting there, if someone lets in a car, it's okay, that's fine, that's just one car. So if they let in 10 cars in front of you, it makes you really angry because they're taking up your space. They're getting in the way of where you want to go. And what's more, if you're driving along and then someone cuts you off, that anger just bursts from within, doesn't it? Or maybe you're not like me. When people get in the way of what we want, we get angry. When that happens with our families, with our work, with anything, we get angry. So the other day, I was refusing to bow down to idols, and this guy threw me in jail. It doesn't happen here, does it? In our culture, idolatry is accepted. We don't really acknowledge it. We don't see it. But the experience of thousands of Christians around the world is that if you don't bow down to other people's idols, you will experience this kind of thing. We're seeing it go on at the moment in Iraq. If you don't bow down to their idols, they will kill you. You pay a tax that will burden you more than you can actually live. And I was reading this week that the aim of the tax is that you would eventually realize your stupidity in not submitting in the first place and submit in the end. If we get in the way of other people's idols, we experience these sorts of things. But in Australia, if we fail to bow down to someone else's idols, the worst is we get a little bit of rejection, maybe a bit of exclusion, maybe a loud argument, maybe some angry words. Sometimes something worse. But if I fail to let money for me be an idol, if I talk to my financial advisor and he sees that I'm getting paid by the church, but I stupidly give money back to the church as well. If he looks at that, he goes, "Why are you tithing that money back? They gave you the money in the first place. Just take it." It doesn't make sense. So people will question your wisdom if you don't bow down to their idols. If I fail to prioritize my wider family, some of my family might get narky about it, but there's nothing more if I don't worship that as an idol. If I fail to do things that call into question my integrity in a workplace, the worst you get is fired. So what happened to those who accused Daniel? Well, they ended up consumed by their idol at the hand of Darius's idol. The same lines that didn't lift a claw to rip apart Daniel, they didn't even lift a claw to him, that seemed impotent to harm him, didn't even let their bodies hit the ground before they were crushed, their bones crushed. But why their families, the wives and the children as well? Well, the law said, well, you throw them in as well to get rid of the ability for them to retribute. Notice again, Darius serves the custom or law in the hope that they will serve and protect him. Well, Matthew 6:24 puts it this way.
No one can serve two masters, for either you will hate the one and love the other, or you will be devoted to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and money. It is spiritually impossible to serve and worship Jesus and serve another idol at the same time. It is spiritually impossible to pursue first, to seek first the kingdom of God, as well as to seek this kingdom of self simultaneously. If you do, you'll find you will be in the struggle that this battle talks about. You'll love the one or hate the one, despise the one as you look to the other. Let me illustrate this, and I'm going to put a slide up again to remind you of what an idol is. Remember, idols can be good things, such as family, work, children, fun, but given the wrong priority, the center of our affections. So over here, I've prepared a little something earlier. Pretend that this post is an idol. And say I was to put this idol in here, in the center of your life. It looks strange, doesn't it? It looks really weird. Like we know that a cross usually goes in that stand, and it obviously looks out of place. But if it's an idol in your life, then you're too busy serving it to notice that it's actually this big eyesore in the middle of your life. And that's how God sees it. He sees this big post, this big thing of worship that shouldn't be worshipped. Let me ask you a question. If I was to watch the video of your last 6 weeks in life, what would I say was important to you? What would I say was making you happy if I was to watch a video of the last 6 weeks of your life? Let me give you a minute to think. There's a piece of paper in front of you. You might like to write down your answer. Let me pray as we do. Lord, please give us a revelation into what you want us to see about what has had a place, a priority in our lives in the last weeks, Lord. Just write it down. You don't have to show anyone else. Now, when you look at this post, imagine that thing is there. Do you spend a lot of time with it? What happens if I try and remove it from the center of your life? Would you get protective? At some level, do you fear losing it? If someone was to point it out and go, I don't think it should be in that place in your life, do you get defensive? Remember, idols can be good things in the wrong place. They can be work. And for us, in our community, in our church in particular, I was praying about it, and I think some of the key idols for us are good things. They are work, as it takes that place at the center of our affection and the purpose we serve in life. They are family, as we put it in that center place. Family is a really good thing, but it's not designed for that place. It is for us, I think, as a community, ourselves or our pleasure that can take that place. Idols are kind of obvious once you see them. But the reality is, you can't have two masters. It just kind of, like, it doesn't work. there's no way you can actually get them to fit together. I mean, the center of your life has only one place that things can go. You just, no matter what you do, you can't put it there. And I mean, the best you can sort of do is you can lean Jesus up against this idol in your life, and you can try and apply him to the idol, but at times you're going to apply him wrong, and it's going to fall down, and what's going to remain is the idol is still there. I mean, it's funny, we've got some money at the bottom here from the early service. We give gifts, we serve our idols, and they take that place in our lives. And as we look at them and we try and remove them, and we they're fixed in really hard. Idols are there in our life because, let's face it, it's hard to remove them. And when we remove it, if we just kind of leave it like that, what's the easiest thing to put back in its place? You put that idol straight back in there. You know, the reality is our idols kind of belong there at the foot of the cross. And the only one that deserves or should have this place of honor in our lives is Jesus. He's the only one that fits perfectly in that place. He's the only one who's designed to replace our idols, and he's the only one who can satisfy us in the way that idols can't. If we try and leave the pole in the center and Jesus on the outer, we will live lives crushed in serving our idols. We'll also crush those around us who don't serve our idols because they get in the way of what we want. But our idols will never serve us in the way that we serve them. If we continue in this, we'll die never knowing the freedom that is received from having Jesus at the center. Our idols will consume us, they'll destroy us, they'll lead us, they'll take us further away from Jesus. And eventually at the judgment seat, Jesus will say, "You didn't worship me. You didn't know me. You worshipped this idol, and you will be consumed by me, the Lion of Judah." Now, we can't displace an idol ourselves. Given the choice, we're always 100% of the time going to put it back where it came from. We will always, given the choice, serve the wrong master. But we should be encouraged that the God who speaks these words, "No one can serve two masters," is the God who came on earth. It is Jesus. Jesus spoke these words, and he left heaven and came to earth to die for addicted, idol-worshipping, self-righteous sinners like us. Only the grace of God found in Jesus can change your heart. Only the grace of God can help you to put Jesus at the center. We can only put patches on our lives and pretend to make things work. But only the grace of God found in Jesus can replace your idols. Only the grace of God found in Jesus will bring you what you seek in these idols. Only the grace of God found in Jesus will free your heart to choose the pleasure of God over the pleasures of this world. Only the grace of God found in Jesus will fill your heart with lasting peace of joy. Only the grace of God found in Jesus will heal your hurts from the past. Only the grace of God found in Jesus will give you a hope for the future. Only the grace of God found in Jesus will enable you to live, worship, and live a life of unshakable faith like Daniel. If we surrender our idols to Jesus, if we repent of them before Jesus and declare them to be what they are, idols, if we ask the Father's forgiveness and the Spirit's freedom, Jesus, who died on the cross, will set us free. No wound was found on Daniel because he trusted in God, the healer, the redeemer, and the doctor of our souls. Will you trust him? The cross of Jesus has already told us that we are people so corrupt that we needed not just a man, but the Son of God to come down on earth and die for us. That's what the cross tells us. There is The devil's trick is shame, and the devil will seek to cause you to feel really ashamed of the idols that you have in life. He'll cause you to focus on yourself instead of Jesus. But there's no shame in coming to Jesus, because the cross already declares that we're, as a people, so broken that we need it. We need redemption. Everyone in this room needs redemption, and only Jesus can do it. We're going to be coming to a time of communion. And as we come to that time, if you haven't used the paper already, I'd like you to write down your idol on that piece of paper. There might be multiple things that change places in the center of your life that aren't Jesus. And what we're going to do as we come to communion is to symbolically bring them, and I'll place the cross down in front of the table. No one has to see these idols, but I would like you to bring that piece of paper and place it at the bottom of the cross. If you like, you can step it under your feet, crush it as a symbol. We'll shred the paper afterwards. No one has to see it. But let me invite you to do that as we come to this time of communion. I'm going to pray, and then Rod's going to lead us.